for those of you who are new to Holden, that banging is not for you, but for the tape ministry people in the other room. This is the first of 4 hours with the general heading Apostles of Nonviolence, and we'll look a minute at what that title itself might mean. I'm John Yoder. My second time at Holden. My business or my training as church historian. And there's an element of church history in what I'll be talking about, more than what some other people would do with the same topic. Before we begin, let's gather our thoughts in prayer. Father, over and over we would renew our gratitude for the gift of reconciliation, which has intervened in our lives through the work and the message of thy Son. Guide our thoughts as we seek as well to know what it means to continue to be bearers of the word of reconciliation, for your glory and for his sake. Amen. My title could be taken three different ways. It was assigned to me by John and Mary Schramm, and I don't know which of the three meanings they meant. Apostles of Nonviolence can point to the fact that there have been some major figures in our cultural history that we ought to know more about. Protestants need to think more responsibly to understand the value of the biography of Christians. When the Protestant movement began, there was a certain pressure against the prominence that the saints had in the thought life and the cultural vision of the medieval Catholic Church. The argument against that was that we're all saints and God is quite satisfied with ordinary Christians and we don't need heroes, and that some of the veneration of the saints put them too much beyond our own history, and there was value in all of that. But there still is also value in Christian biography. And I haven't noticed around Holden that there are very many Lutherans who think as critically of Martin Luther as he himself did. So at least you have some understanding of the lives of saints, and I'm just suggesting he wasn't the only one. Nonviolence has a history. There are persons from distant history and more recent history who have thought about and especially who have acted in this other lifestyle. Most people know something about St. Francis. Not many people know as much about his contemporary Peter Waldo or Pierre Vaudès. Very few people know about the 15th century Reformation figure Peter Chelczycki, who was a pioneer before the Reformation, before what we call the Reformation, in what the Czechs call the First Reformation. Most of us know something about George Fox and William Penn because they come to the surface in our Western political history. Most of us don't know as much about Gerard Winstanley or even about John Bunyan and Roger Williams as it would take to put them on our map as personages. Now, the first thing to say about this sequence of apostles is just that it brings to the surface an awareness that most of us weren't given by our schooling or our church schooling, that there is a subculture with its own history of people challenging the linkage of the Christian faith with the state and with violence and with the crusade, and doing that in the name of the gospel, long before there was a word like nonviolence coined to describe it. And all through the time when the official reading and writing of history, even of Christian history, was the story of governments and kings and bishops and management structures in the churches. That's the first point. Secondly, it brings us up to the present to observe that in our time, there has been a surfacing or perhaps a kind of cresting of a wave of more of this kind of apostolic ministry. Cresting in terms of quantity, there are more people, at least more visible people worth talking about than in earlier centuries. A certain cresting in terms of quality, they're more original, they tackle more subjects. They apply the critique of violence from a gospel perspective to more questions with more creativity and more experimentation. I'll be looking mostly at three figures in modern times, and they're very different from one another. I won't be telling the story of any one of them with any adequate background at all. That doesn't mean I assume you know enough, although you certainly know at least their names. Leo Tolstoy lived through most of the last century and was a storyteller, a writer, author of famous novels, who in mid-career had a kind of Christian conversion, focusing on the centrality of the problem of violence and its rejection in the name of the gospel. From then on, he portrayed this new witness in his stories and novels, but also in argumentative writing and journalistic writing and social action. Mohandas Gandhi, called Mahatma, which is a title of endearment, lived, overlapped with Tolstoy, half a generation, lived until the Second World War and the independence of India. He had Christian friends and acquaintances when he studied in England, when he worked as a lawyer in South Africa, but of course he's known as the man who led the Indian people in a movement of national renewal and moral pressure upon the British in the direction of national independence. Martin Luther King Jr. is the third figure, the American and the Protestant in the package, whose activity began just a little over 20 years ago and ended with his death, victim of an assassin, as Gandhi always also had been, in 1968. Those are the three I'll refer to the most because probably you have something of a notion of where they stand in our cultural history, but there are many more. There is a book in the bookstore on the butcher block for special attention entitled Struggle for Humanity, in which two authors report their own visits a decade ago, traveling some in Latin America and Europe, interviewing people. They describe a good handful, six or eight, major figures, in addition to the ones I've been talking about. One of them is the Italian Gandhian Catholic, who just died very recently, Lanza del Vasto, whose book on his visit to Gandhi is in the bookstore. Another is the Brazilian Catholic Archbishop, Helder Camara, who will be the subject of a film here this Thursday, the main subject. But then there are many more. Dorothy Day, a Catholic, what should we call her, social worker, agitator, journalist, meditative person. Some of her meditations are also in the bookstore, who also died just about a year ago. And then people still living, Cesar Chavez, the Berrigans, Jim Douglas, and another person who died a decade ago, the Catholic monk Thomas Merton. Now, all of these people, they're not the only ones in the book by Hope and Young, but all these people are Roman Catholic. How that happens would be worth a separate study. What I'll be talking about is a distillation of themes that underlie these stories of all of these people, but especially the first three. But I won't do it in terms of the biographies of those three people, except as it comes to the surface to illustrate, or as you might want to pursue that in the free conversation. The second meaning of the title, Apostles of Nonviolence, points in another direction. It's that we are all called to be some kind of bearers of a message. An apostle is linguistically simply somebody who is sent. All Christians are supposed to be somehow sent and messengers. And reconciliation has to be a part of that message. Nonviolence is too small a term for all of the meaning of reconciliation, but it is a key term that helps define the conditions of authenticity. If our reconciliation message is violent, then it isn't authentic reconciliation. The third meaning of the term apostles, the one that will now decide which way I'll organize the rest of this introduction, is to think especially of the New Testament as apostolic writings, and to look for the rootings of what I'll be talking about in a few of the major themes of New Testament thought. Not New Testament thought in the sense that we would be doing picky and very thorough study of biblical texts, but the style of the early Christian understanding of the place of the church in the world. And not just ideas, not just certain concepts which would then lead to renouncing violence, but rather the whole stance of the early Christian church in her world and how it makes sense that that stance should have been without violence, or more than that, should have included the renunciation of violence. So we have at one end of the scale the New Testament teachings. At the other end of the scale, we have recent apostles and saints illustrating the same thing. I'll be taking some of the principles out of the New Testament and some of the illustrations out of the present and watching them interact with each other. And in a sense, that's not cheating, because that's the way it really happened. These people usually became critical of the dominant violent ethos of the culture in which they worked because they'd been reading the Bible. Obviously, and very bluntly, this was the case in Tolstoy, and even Gandhi, as a non-Christian, came to his perspective because of an encounter with the message of Tolstoy and the message of Jesus through Tolstoy, which he found in the Christian world, even though Christians were so different from that he was never attracted to being a Christian. But he was attracted to Jesus. And Martin Luther King, of course, as a black Baptist preacher, it represents that stream of Western Christianity that has long made the point that we never get beyond recourse to the Bible itself as our dominant guide for preaching and practice. So it's not inappropriate for us to look at the biblical roots of nonviolence, although many of our contemporaries have come to understandings of nonviolent commitment from other sources, and many of them aren't Christian. Now, I said the word nonviolence is too small a term to be an equivalent for reconciliation, yet it does point us to a special correlation. Not all ethical questions have the same shape and weight. There are many ethical questions: truth-telling, sexuality, property, family structures. One of the mistakes we make is to think that we must deal with all of them in the same way. There is a sense in which the issue of violence is an issue concerning which Christians have failed more profoundly than some other areas. And so I don't apologize for the selectivity that makes the issue of violence a special standpoint from which to watch history and gives it more attention than changing concepts of family structure or changing concepts of economic ownership, which also would be worth studying through Christian history. Also there are stories of failure and change. The next stumbling block in getting at the subject is that the term nonviolence is itself semantically a strange term. It's a funny kind of word. First of all, it's formally a negative word, nonviolence. We don't usually proceed that way elsewhere in our ethics. If you undertook a study of the Christian family, you wouldn't concentrate on the word non-adultery, but you'd have an affirmative word, fidelity. In the field of truth-telling, you wouldn't say simply non-prevarication, but you'd say truth-telling. Somehow, nonviolence has become a tool of conversation that keeps making us stumble over the notion that it's negative. And we'll have to explain why it isn't negative, because it is, linguistically. And why isn't it in its substance? Furthermore, the word is an abstraction, violence. It comes from an adjective. Nonviolent was used before nonviolence. The adjective was used before the noun. But even the adjective is an abstract one. Are we sure we know what is violent and what isn't? Nonviolence as a noun tends to be used for something much narrower than that which is not violent. If a mother feeds her child, that's usually a nonviolent activity, but we don't think of it as nonviolence. Of course, some feeding situations get violent, but we hope not from the mother's side. If a teacher communicates valid learnings to her class, that's a nonviolent activity, usually. But we don't think of it. The term has tended to be used for a much narrower scope of specific activities related to civil disobedience, even law-breaking, or to what some people call direct action. That is a way of bypassing the channels with which other people want you to process a certain question. That may also sometimes be a misnomer, because what is called direct action is sometimes only symbolically direct. I don't mean to concentrate only on tactics of nonviolent direct action, but on the Christian reasons for renouncing violence, which is therefore much broader. But that means it's also much vaguer. Was Jesus violent ever? And we have the story of the cleansing of the temple, for instance. What does that mean? Does that contribute to definition of the word violence? If we say Jesus is a model for nonviolence, well, then what was that? Can a social order be called violent when there is no bloodshed going on, when it is apparently at peace? In the past 20 years, especially in the past 10 years, it's become a dominant thought pattern. People thinking about the problems of social justice in the so-called third world have come to talk about structural violence, by which they mean peaceable situations, that is, places where nobody is getting shot right now, but which, in their injustice of structure, hurt people in a way that's just as questionable morally as if they were going to shoot each other with guns. If in a Brazilian slum, or for that matter in a North American slum, but the people talking about it are mostly from Latin America using these terms, if because of inequities in the distribution of food or health care, most of the infants die in a given slum because they didn't get the food that was there but not distributed properly, or they didn't get the medical attention that they needed, which was available in that country, in that city, but not distributed fairly, those babies are just as dead as if somebody had shot them. But they have been killed by the structure, not by a gun. So that's structural violence. That concept has become widespread. Well, what does that do to the usability of the word violence to distinguish between one action and another? Similarly, from psychological perspectives, people can talk about doing violence to any subordinate group, to children or youth, to women, to lay people, through the exercise of authority in which there is no arm twisting or no physical force, but where something about the shape of the relationship violates. Up until now, I have been trying to define a term without making sure whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. But the overtone has been the assumption that it's always bad. But is it always bad? Well, that itself has to be asked. Is all violence wrong? The classical majority answer of Christians since the 4th century is no. It is evil, as it would be better not to have it. But there are some times when it is the lesser evil. And some other thing is so much worse that the violence is justifiable even though it is too bad. And you have to ask what the just cause is, what the situation is, in which it is, although regrettable, still necessary. With regard to the violence of war, there you have the doctrine of the justifiable war, which is a classic mainstream Christian doctrine. With regard to violence within the state, you have the doctrine of the state and the righteous violence, the justified violence of the state in certain circumstances. There's another set of arguments put most radically by a black African, who at the time he wrote was, however, working in North Africa, in Algeria, Franz, I don't know where he got a German first name, Franz Fanon, who spoke of violence as psychotherapy. If you have been a slave, the only way you'll know that you are somebody is if you can kill somebody who represents the culture which enslaved you. So if in a movement of national liberation, the former subjects rise up and kill somebody, it doesn't matter whom they kill. It doesn't matter if the people who represent to them the oppressive regime are innocent personally. They represent the need of these subject peoples for enfranchisement, for empowerment, and that is best lived out at the cost of somebody. And this, of course, was to interpret the violence of the Algerian Revolution in the early 1960s. This revolution caused suffering to many people of French background who lived in Algeria who had not personally done anything wrong to any Arab. But they were part of a system which was enslaving, and therefore the Arab striking back is psychotherapeutically understandable. That's Fanon's argument. And a third way to debate whether all violence is wrong is to observe that even nonviolent action can provoke violence in two different ways. One way is that it provokes violence against the people who initiate the nonviolent action, and that's sometimes expected. That is, Gandhi organized people to march to places they were not supposed to march, and they were struck down by the British colonial police, or Martin Luther King in the same sense. So there is the violence that the nonviolent people suffer, that they provoke against themselves, that would not have been exercised against them if they'd stayed home and kept their peace. Worse than that, of course, there is the violence when occasionally the followers of a movement go beyond its discipline. There were a few times in the Gandhian experience and a few times in King's experience when the movement itself was discredited by people who were part of a procession, who, however, didn't remain within the nonviolent discipline and started throwing stones or breaking windows or striking back at the police, where the nonviolent leader had triggered something that he then wasn't able to keep within the limits of his own conviction. All of that is just to spread the problem before us. For now, I disavow trying to solve this problem on the level of words by getting the right definition of violence, but only using this awareness of the problem of words that we stumble over as a way to back into the way it seems to me most constructive to see the case against violence, which I'll try to make without claiming that I've cleared up all of those loose edges of definition. I said that the abstract noun and adjective violent, violence, come from a verb to violate. That's a transitive verb. That is, it has an object. You don't violate. You violate something or someone. You may violate a custom or a law, or you violate the integrity or the life of a person. Those of you who know French or Spanish know that it's also the normal word for rape. To violate is to attack the integrity of something or some value, some person. Then the meaning of nonviolence at its very heart, for my present purposes, is that it represents the commitment not to violate the integrity, which means both the life and the dignity, of any fellow human being. You talk about nonviolence to pigeons and chipmunks some other time. There is also an agenda there, but not of the same depth. It's valuable to say it that way because then we get saved from the danger of thinking that it's only a matter of being legalistic about bloodshed. Now, you can violate people's integrity without killing them. And Jesus says that on one level, at least, that's no better. So we're talking about a positive commitment to the integrity of our fellow human being, especially the adversary or the enemy. Nonviolence is simply the backhanded, negative, abstract word for saying, I'm committed firmly to the dignity of my fellow human being. Now, how does the Bible affirm that dignity? What is the language of the Bible to say that the most basically? Well, all up and down the laws of the Old Testament, all of the laws of the Old Testament that have to do with other people have to do with the not violating the dignity of those people, their rights, their possessions, their honor, etc. But more deeply and more narrowly also than that, there are especially two ways that are the most important for now. In the Old Testament, at a key point, it is a relationship to God himself, and that is striking. There aren't many places where human nature is correlated with the nature of God himself, but it is in the creation story, where it is said that God made humankind in his image, and it is in Genesis chapter 9, after the flood, when Noah and his progeny are given the command to repopulate the earth. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And there are some people think that culture was vegetarian before the flood, and now this is the first authorization of eating animal flesh. I wasn't there, so I'm not sure about that. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. For your life blood I will surely require reckoning of every beast. Of every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his own image. Now, on this level, the sanction for bloodshed is more bloodshed. That's not the New Testament. But the reason that the dignity of human life is to be defended is that man was made in God's image. It is. That's the strongest way that the Bible can say that human dignity is, well, we could say absolute, although that's a word that makes for philosophical puzzles in spelling out what all it means. It is an ultimate value. How can you say anything stronger about a value than to say it reflects the image of God? But in the New Testament, it's said a different way, but also with a reference to God that is also unique. And that is at the end of Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus contrasts what he is saying with what people had understood hitherto. This, of course, has to be distilled out of something that would be worthy of much more extended treatment. You all know the passage, but let's look again at its logic. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. That's the contrast that's set up, and we'll come back to that another time. But how does it conclude? You must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. The comparison is with the Father. Now, often we're told to follow Jesus, and we'll talk about that some other time. Once in a while, the Apostle Paul gets up the nerve to say that his readers ought to imitate him. But this is the only place, I think, where we're told to be like the Father. This text and its direct parallel in Luke's Gospel, chapter 6. The love command in the teachings of Jesus goes beyond loving the neighbor in the Hebrew heritage in two ways. One way we'll talk about the next time. But here it is, the neighbor that you are to love includes the enemy. Is not just the near neighbor. Our English language is especially weak at this point. Most of the other modern languages distinguish between neighbor, as somebody who lives near to us, and neighbor as the person you deal with. In French, you have the difference between le voisin and le prochain. In German, between the Nachbar and the Nächste. Any intelligent language has that distinction, except English. We are not told to love the people who live close to us. We are told to love the person with whom we have to do. And we're told that the ultimate test of that is when the person with whom you have to do is an enemy. Because when you love that person, then you are like God. Because he loves his enemies. Now, I want to avoid overemphasis on the Sermon on the Mount as if it were the only place where this kind of ethical focus were to be found. But it does happen. This one point happens to be made the most precisely just at the end of Matthew 6 and Matthew 5 and Luke 6. Now, what does it mean to be perfect like the Father? It helps to see what it doesn't mean. One notion which we find in the Reformation time, but also in as modern a person as the late Reinhold Niebuhr, is that Jesus' purpose here was really to tell people that you can't do it. He was intentionally asking for the moon in the knowledge that he doesn't have any moons listening to him, and that this would prove to people their guilt. That is the condemning use of the law. Now, there is a condemning use of the law, but there's no grounds for in the text for thinking that that's what he's talking about here. Screwing up the demands so much that we can't do them, and then we'll just know we're sinners and we have to come to God for grace. We already knew that without the demands having to be escalated this much. He's making a different point. There is then the Wesley interpretation. John Wesley himself, in a moderate degree, and 19th century American revivalists who call themselves Wesleyan to much greater degree, taught and believed and experienced in their minds a degree of liberation from the burden of sin through a deepening spiritual experience different from conversion, which they sometimes called Christian perfection. And there are denominations to this day, Wesleyan denominations in America, that hold to this possible experience as a promise to any sincere Christian. Now, that's not what Jesus is talking about. Roman Catholicism has a different way, historically had a different way of slicing the agenda of a moral concern. There is the level of the law, the precepts, which are for everybody to keep and are keepable by everybody. Everyone is held to that. And then there are the counsels of the gospel, the evangelical counsels, or the counsels of perfection, which are only for those people who want to go an extra distance in sacrifice and service, and then those people will promise poverty and chastity and obedience and nonviolence. So that this perfection is for a few people who want to do more than the others. Well, there's nothing about that in the text either. I could stretch out the list of things that people have taken this term perfection to mean that it doesn't mean, as far as I can see. It has a much simpler meaning, which is explained in the other half of the verse. Be like your Father because he sends the sun and the rain to the good and the evil alike. Or in Matthew and in Luke, he is merciful to the ungrateful. God is indiscriminate in his love. He loves his enemies like his friends, and that's what we're called to do. It's not easy, but it's not unthinkable. It's not out of this world. It's something, it's a call which is meaningful. So the enemy is not only a test of whether our love is general, that is, you ought to love everybody, thus also you must love the enemy. It's deeper than that. It's the test of whether our love is like God's love instead of like our own love. Because we love our friends, but God loves his enemies. This focus on the special reason for caring about the dignity of the adversary has been expressed in different ways through history, but as I look at the apostles of nonviolence that I'm talking only about early modern times. George Fox used the phrase that he said of his own ministry that he was speaking to that of God in every man. What did he mean by that of God in every man? Fox was a Puritan. That is, a person from the epoch when people had the practice of struggling with God for a time, some of them for years, and keeping a careful record of their struggles, writing journals so that they knew their spiritual biography, until they came to a point where their selfishness had been overpowered by the grace of God. The Quaker was the extreme Puritan in that sense. He just was more of the same as what other Puritans also claimed to experience. Having experienced the power of God to turn me around, through his grace, without violence, just by outweighing my selfishness, I have to think that that same power of God can turn anybody else around. So I have no right to look at any other person except as the possible bearer of that same overpowering, non-coercive love of God that has won me. So I state the dignity of my adversary by saying of him that the reconciling love of God which I have experienced applies to him too. That's the spiritual dynamic of the Quaker way of talking about why it is that you don't violate your enemy. Leo Tolstoy said it more simply because he was carrying on a campaign of simplification over against the complexity of Orthodox Eastern Catholicism and its bondage and linkage with the imperial throne of Russia. He wanted a fulcrum for radical critique. He himself was coming back from unbelief and had found a faith that was simple and focused just on this word of Jesus. And for him, it's a simplification because it's a test of simple authority. Jesus says this. Is he sent to give us a way of life? Yes or no? If he is, then we do it. His reason for loving the enemy is a test of the authority of Christ. And to make it anything more than that, to explain or to ask why it'll work, or to doubt that it would work, or to adapt it to situations, is fundamental unbelief. So that his statement of it didn't add much to the substance, but just dramatized bluntly the claim. Jesus says, if you're going my way, you will love your enemy. That's the only way to go my way. Gandhi, while learning from Tolstoy, updated his message and put it into the language of another culture, and not specifically Christian culture. Truth is the encounter of various minds. Truth arises out of that encounter. I trust my truth, of course, but if I really trust my truth to be true, then I must not impose it coercively on my interlocutor. I must believe that my truth is so true that my adversary can see it if I just say it right and get his attention. Further, the adversary, even if it's an oppressor, is for me a source of truth because I'm finite, and even if the adversary is wrong about what I know he's wrong about, he's still also a bearer of truth, so that I must encounter in my adversary the truth of which he also is a bearer. So Gandhi entitled his biography, The Story of My Experiments with Truth. I renounce violence in my relation to my adversary so that out of our encounter, even if it be at the cost of my suffering, truth will come. And the oppressor must not be crushed in my concern for liberation because it's the oppressor who needs to be liberated by the truth that he is an oppressor, which he will only learn if he experiences himself oppressing me by my showing him that I'm a victim of his oppression, which he doesn't see normally because his oppressiveness is clothed with respectability. But if I get in his way and he hurts me, he becomes aware of the truth of his being an oppressor, and he can only learn that by crushing me. He can't learn that by my crushing him. That's Gandhi's restatement of the dignity of the other part. Martin Luther King, bringing this message back to America and back to Christian vocabulary, said it in many ways, the way I just heard him again on a recent film playback that we saw in California, was his direct statement that love is not soft, but love cares enough for the enemy to want to set him right, even at the cost of my life. Love is not soft. Love is not fuzzy. It encounters, but it is committed, again, to the dignity of the other party. If I'd had more of a library along, I would have added at this point some more quotes from a specifically Lutheran transposition of this message. That is from German Lutherans who know that everything has to have to do with proclamation to be true. Dietrich Fischinger is a young New Testament scholar in South Germany, and Hans-Werner Bartsch in Frankfurt. Bartsch is somewhat better known because he edited some things that were translated. Both of them, German Lutherans, saying that the reason I must reject violence is that my action must proclaim to my adversary that God justifies the godless. And the only way I can say that to a person is that my actions toward that person support their dignity when they don't have any dignity. The only way I can be acting justification by pure grace toward a person who needs to hear that message, that's the Lutheran word, is to act as if they had a dignity which they don't have. That's the incarnation of the message of free forgiveness, is to act toward someone, act out my forgiveness of that person by showing that I don't hold his being my enemy against him. I don't even let his being my enemy be true. He's my friend because of God's grace, although he acts like my enemy. Now, none of this describes or prescribes yet techniques and tactics of nonviolent action. But my concern, especially for this first introductory time, is to make the point that we don't start there, although it is worth talking about how Gandhi and King operated, or how Tolstoy took a doctrinaire position without having a social strategy. That's not where we need to start if we want to understand that the nonviolent movement in our time is basically a movement of biblically oriented renewal and social critique. It is not, first of all, a liberal Western tactic of making democracy work better where it has been failing, although it is that. It's, first of all, a biblically oriented critique of the violent and coercive qualities of established Christianity in the past millennium and a half, and it clearly came out of reference to the New Testament and to this element of the New Testament. So the vision is far more than not wanting to shed blood. In fact, nonviolent encounters involve bloodshed, and sometimes more than if they hadn't raised the question. In fact, often. But their rootage is in the nature of God's grace and what it takes to communicate it authentically. God himself is a God who loves his enemies. That's what he tells us in Jesus when we are his enemies. The only way we can be vehicles of the word of that reconciliation is for our actions in situations of conflict, as well as our words, to say that. Now, there might be other ways to say it that would be more accessible to non-Christians, or that would be more modern, or that would be more sociologically functional. But this is at the core of the Sermon on the Mount and at the core of the renewal of these modern figures, Fox, Tolstoy, Gandhi, King, the location of the renewal of perspective. We'll have to talk later about what it costs, about other values that may have to be relativized or sacrificed. I think the first point is this one. There is a theological stake, there is a gospel stake in my saying of my enemy that I am here to be a vehicle of God's love for my enemy, specifically. If I'm only a vehicle of love for my friends, or for the people who don't threaten me, or for the people who earn survival, then I may be just. But it's not gospel. So much for introduction. It took a little longer than I thought, but we still have a good 10 minutes for any kind of response. Now, there are people in the village here who have been studying recently and thinking recently about these subjects more than I, but I guess some of them aren't here. So feel free to take off in any direction.
Our enemy, do we portray that as an emotional kind of love like you have towards your friends, or is it a more one of acceptance and tolerance and all those other words?
The Martin Luther King film that I just referred to shows King making that point very clearly. Love is not an emotion. That is, the love we're talking about here in terms of Christian morality is not an emotion. It is an action. It means seeking the welfare of that other person. And sometimes, well, I think normally, one would learn to have a kind of affective respect for that person, but it isn't based on that we do it. In fact, it's the most important that we express concern for the welfare of persons for whom we have no attraction. And that's the contrast that Jesus draws at more length, as you know, in the passage I didn't fully read. if you love those who love you, what's special about that? So there's a clear contrast between the gospel quality of commitment to the welfare of the dignity of the other person, and the other things that we also properly call love, like affectiveness and emotion, tenderness, belonging together, familiarity, and all those things.
Is there, in the context of nonviolence, a place for righteous anger?
I think that's a fitting prolongation of the last question. I suspect that the term righteous anger means various things too. If it actually influences our action in the sense that it makes us lash out or seek to destroy or defame, then it isn't righteous after all. If, on the other hand, there is a degree of impatience or disgust with how recalcitrant people are, and especially if it includes an element of seeing myself in the person I'm angry at because I'm that way too, then I think that there can be elements of vigor and rigor and impatience in nonviolent action that are part of it. And for that purpose, I'm glad that we have the story of the cleansing of the temple, although we don't have any specific discussion of Jesus' relation to individuals there. So this focus on the dignity of the adversary that I've been talking about isn't strong in that text. It's clear that Jesus was loud and pushy and impatient. He didn't kill anybody. I don't think he even defamed anybody, but he let them know that they weren't in a, that their commerce didn't belong there then. And he made a considerable ruckus, more than we see in the text, because we don't have much imagination when we read it. What is translated oxen was not oxen, because the only possible proper sacrifice is a flawless bull. So they were bullocks, they were not oxen. And likewise, the sheep were not ewes, they were rams, so probably vigorous animals. When he let all those animals loose in the street, and you can see the money changers scrambling over the cobblestones to pick up their pennies, it must have been a riotous scene. So it's fitting that there be vigor and that there be oratory, especially in Martin Luther King. Gandhi was no orator at all, but King certainly was. That there will be, even in a sense, if we can use the word in a good sense, demagoguery, that is leadership, powerful dramatizing of the awareness of people of the moral depth of what's going on. So it's important that nonviolence does not mean only that everybody ought to become an understated Englishman and accentuate things only by saying them more quietly.
You didn't say too much about the Old Testament prophets in this whole discussion of nonviolence. How do you characterize some of them? Amos, Jeremiah.
Well, there are more things that I left out of the Old Testament story because it is a more complex agenda. The wars of the Old Testament are also a problem. The prophets of the Old Testament, I think, are a good example of what we've just been talking about. Their language was strong and sometimes judgmental, but they were always calling their listeners to repent. They were never seeking the destruction of anybody they preached at. They may shame them, they may shock them, they may surprise them, but they were always calling for even the most inadequate of the Jewish kings to come back and to repent, even though they knew he wouldn't. It was still a message that left open the possibility that they might be heard. And they expected their words to carry weight. They didn't mobilize zealot troops to reinforce their position. And in fact, most of the prophets had an element of suffering. And the prophets we know best, Isaiah and Jeremiah, there's a deep element of suffering and rejection. So the prophets are also prefiguring of Jesus' nonviolence. I'll say a little more of that when we get to the suffering servant as related to Jesus' model.
Yes, you said, several people said that submit to your oppressor in order that he might see his being an oppressor. What about if that oppressor never sees that or never realizes that he is oppressing?
Well, that raises the question of time and patience. Gandhi would say, well, we'll keep on. Gandhi had a very long view of history. Martin Luther King had a shorter view of history because he was an American. And he didn't have to face that. Things did move. So we can't ask each of our sources to answer all of our questions. But either of them would have said, if this is the right way to act, then if the oppressor takes longer, we'll still keep coming back. And there were times when Martin Luther King spoke to a longer prospect that maybe it won't all come tomorrow. We shall overcome someday. It doesn't always mean tomorrow. And that if we have to come back again and again and again, especially in the mobilization of some of the strikes and boycotts, there was a lot of patience in the sense that we don't say we won't use violence today, but we will tomorrow. No, we already say today we won't use violence tomorrow either. That's part of the proclamation. So that the oppressor's bullheadedness and slowness and stubbornness and blindness, that's part of what we're willing to work with because God is. So it isn't a short-range tactic that you use until you have to shift gears into something more effective.
Is that kind of the Jewish people's reasoning for so willfully submitting themselves to what I thought was willful submission into the Jewish concentration camps, into the concentration camps?
I think willing submission is a little too strong, but there is something in Jewish nonviolence through the centuries that that does have something of this tone. It's a little different because the Jewish suffering, the Jewish acceptance of continuing to be Jewish despite all of the suffering that Christians have imposed upon them, was never thought of as intending to convert the Christians to Judaism. The Jews just understood that as sanctifying the name of God. That is, the fact that we're willing to die for the glory of God, that's what we can do for the name of God. We can't please God, we can't make ourselves acceptable to him, but we can sanctify his name. And that's what Jews understood they were doing when they accepted Christian persecution through the centuries. So it did make sense, but that is a little different from the patience of the nonviolent activist, because the nonviolent activist does hope to convert the oppressor.
John, what do you see as the role of the person who isn't being oppressed but sees the oppression, sees the injustice? How does that fit in this frame?
Well, I don't think the third party is in this frame in the actual texts or the language, so we just have to think about that. We have to build bridges to that thought. One argument is that the victim themselves shouldn't fight back, but third parties should fight back or should intervene as third parties violently. I can't follow that, but I recognize it's a different chapter of the argument than it isn't present there. The argument is usually most strongly stated that I'm willing to sacrifice myself, if I'm a spiritual hero, at least I should be, I could conceive of that, but I shouldn't be willing to sacrifice somebody else's self. That sounds impressive, especially from our perspective, our understandings of social responsibility. But it closes the door to the possibility that this other victim's nonviolence, if genuine, might be interfered with by my third-party righteousness, and that maybe the thing I ought to do is to identify with that victim in more nonviolent encounter with the same oppressor, as over against coming in and being more righteous because we're a third party or a neutral party, and therefore having a mandate to do something that the victim themselves shouldn't do as a Christian.
Good example of that would be the Swedish fellow that went to Poland to help liberate the Jews. I can't remember his name. It was on public television a couple of
years. I remember something of the story. Well, there were a few Gentile Christians in the Hitler time who went to the SS and said, don't take those Jews, take me.
not many, but at least two or three. And I suspect that was just as fruitful as trying to shoot the SS man.
Using your definition of violence and violate, it would seem that clearly the Berrigans, and you mentioned them earlier, don't fit the definition in terms of the activities that they've perpetrated in their civil disobedient actions. They have clearly violated federal property, state properties in their actions, and I'm wondering how would you address their latest, for example, their latest excursion in Pennsylvania with respect to the nonviolence of their actions.
That's a very fitting question. I don't think I'm quite ready for it if you're going to be here part of the rest of the week.
Sure.
It belongs in here. That is violence against property, and especially property that has a symbolic value, like an atomic nose cone or the fence of a Trident base, is that because it's against the law or because it destroys property of the same moral quality, or can the case be made that it's different because, and then you'd have to spell out the because.
Well, I was pursuing the definition used earlier, that violence is against
the I backed through the word violate and said that about the dignity of a person. To say it about the dignity of a nose cone or a cyclone fence would take another couple steps. But I grant we have to talk about it. I don't mean to have set it aside. This should be the last question because it's time for Vesper.
Where would you place Bonhoeffer in his attempt there with the group that was plotting the death of Hitler?
I place him Wednesday morning.